When I think of history, I think of John Adams. John Adams, of course, is the second president of the United States, and he's the one that had to follow George Washington. Can you imagine being the president after George Washington? Not only being the president after him, but they wanted him to stay. They wanted him to go a third term and a fourth term, and he said, no, two is going to be the limit, and he wouldn't stay any longer. So when John Adams was elected, he was elected because George Washington wouldn't be president anymore. That's some hard shoes to fill. I think around here, when Woody Hayes retired, that wouldn't be a job most people would want, to be the guy that would follow somebody that was so flamboyant and so known and so successful. Yeah, okay. I think of the guy that had to succeed Jack Hiles at the church in Hammond, Indiana, a church of 5,000-6,000 people, and he passes away and somebody's got to come in. And a lot of those large churches have a problem because the next guy that comes in has to fill the shoes of the guy that was there. Dallas Billington over in Akron, Ohio, Dr. Cummins, Henniger up in Canton. They built some big churches and someone has to fill their shoes when they're gone. And those are some jobs that you wouldn't envy a whole lot, but let's talk about a different one tonight. Let's talk about the replacement for Moses. The guy that wrote the first five books of the Bible, how'd you like to be the guy that came in on his coattail? How'd you like to be the guy that had to succeed Moses? The one that led the children of Israel out of Egypt. The one that got the Ten Commandments up on top of Mount Sinai. And yet somebody had to succeed. There has to be somebody after that. And that fella, as you know, was Joshua. Joshua is an oft-mentioned fellow in the Bible. His name appears well over 200 times. Most of those, of course, in the book of Joshua as we read about his life. But Joshua was the successor to Moses. And it was through his leadership that the children of Israel entered into the promised land. Moses, because of the strife at Meribah, Moses, because of his disobedience to God, was not allowed to enter into Canaan. God let him go up to the top of a mountain and look across into it, but he wasn't allowed. He died up on that mountain. And Joshua was chosen by God to be the successor that would lead the children of Israel into that promised land. God would not leave his people without a leader. Usually it's, and even in the Bible, it was a son that would succeed. And we don't know what happened to Moses' two sons, Gershom and Eliezer, but we know that Gershom had a son named Jonathan that we read about in the book of Judges, and he was a priest, but he was a corrupt one. He became a priest to the Danites and fostered their idolatry, and that was Moses' grandson, so we don't know what happened there. But God had to go outside of the family circle, had to go outside of the line to find the successor to Moses. Joshua, to this day, is used as a model, can I say a role model, for leadership. Finding someone that's going to succeed Moses to lead the children of Israel, to fill those shoes for the rest of his life, maybe 30 years. We know Joshua died at 110 years old. We don't really know how old he was when he began filling the shoes of Moses, but we guess he was about 80 years old. So for the next 30 years, he's getting the children of Israel into the promised land, getting them settled before he passes off the scene. So we're going to look tonight at this man, Joshua, as we've been studying on Wednesday nights different Bible characters. Last week we looked at Balaam, and tonight we come to the book of Joshua, and we're going to look at Joshua. His story is told in 24 chapters here. Also, when he first appears in Exodus, and there's a lot written about him in Numbers and a little bit in Deuteronomy, and we'll make reference to those. But we're going to look at Joshua tonight. First of all, letter A, his background. His background. When you want a good leader, you know what they usually do? We call it in our day vetting. Vetting. When a person says, I'm going to run for office, they get some professionals to come in and check his background, check his or her history to find out where the skeletons are, because they know the opposition is going to find those skeletons. Michelle Bachmann, the three or four-term senator from Minnesota, pronounced today that she's not going to run for another term. And all the enemies just got excited about that. Oh, Minnesota will be a better state because she's not going to run anymore. They're just waiting in the bushes, waiting for anything they can look on. So God is going to vet Joshua. He's going to give us his background so that we can see that he was prepared by God for leadership. He was prepared before he ever filled the shoes of Moses. God had been preparing him under Moses' tutorage to be able to lead the children of Israel when Moses passed off the scene. And so the Bible gives us a pretty thorough biography of this man, Joshua. First of all, we see him as a son. As a son. Take your Bible, if you would, and go to the book of Numbers. We're going to turn quite a bit tonight as we look at Joshua. Again, his story is told in the 24 chapters of the book of Joshua, but we get an introduction to him back in Numbers chapter 13. Joshua is not his birth name. He was called by another name until Moses chose him to be his successor and his servant and his minister. In Numbers chapter 13, again, you're familiar with the stories. Before they enter into the promised land, they have to spy it out. And they send 12 men, one from each of the 12 tribes. They send them into the promised land to go check it out. And 10 of the spies come back and say, it's inhabited by giants. The Anakims are there. The grapes are as big as gourds, as big as our heads. It's a beautiful land, but we can't go in. The Anakims are there. Joshua and Caleb are the two that went in and said, no, we can have it. God will deliver it into our hands. And we read about them in verse number 6 of number 13. Again, the list is given beginning in verse 4 down through verse 15 of the 12 individuals that were sent. And verse 6 tells us of the tribe of Judah, Caleb. All right, one of the two spies that came back with a positive report. And then verse number 8, of the tribe of Ephraim, Oshea, the son of Nun. Now, Oshea is the fellow we're looking at tonight. He was called at birth Oshea. The name Oshea simply means, and I've lost my note, help. It means help. That's what the name Oshea means. It means help. But notice in verse 16, out of the 12 different, Joshua and Caleb, of course, come back with the report. Verse 16 says, these are the names of the men which Moses sent to spy out the land. And Moses called Oshea, the son of Nun, Jehoshua. All right, later shortened to Joshua. But he called him Jehoshua. Moses changed his name. When you go from Oshea to Jehoshua, you add the J-E at the beginning. And when you add that J-E or J-E-H, you know what that is? That's Jehovah. And so instead of meaning help, it means God is our help. That's what Moses changed his name to. God is our help, or God is our salvation. So as a son, as a child, he was the son of Nun. That's that trivia question, Bible question. Who had no father? Joshua, he was the son of Nun. All right, now that's N-U-N, not N-O-N-E. But he was the son of Nun. He was a tribe of Ephraim, and his name was Oshea. But Moses changed it to Joshua, or God is our salvation. Number two, look at Joshua not only as a son, but look at him as a slave. As a slave. We're introduced to Joshua, and we'll look at it in a minute, in Exodus chapter 17. That's when we first find him. And we understand that Joshua was one of the children of Israel who came out of the slavery in Egypt. All right, he is in-house leadership. When Moses goes off the scene, they're not picking someone that's new. They're not picking someone really even that's young. He's about 80 years old, which back then 80 wasn't that old when you lived to be 110. But he was someone that knew the history of the children of Israel. He had been part of the slavery in Egypt. He'd been part of the servanthood. He knew the whip. He knew the lash. He knew the beginning all the way back from Exodus. So when the children of Israel started crying out, as they did several times, oh, would to God we were back in Egypt. I wish we were back there where we had the leeks and the onions and the garlic and ate to the full. Joshua could say, what? He was back there too. He could say, you didn't have leeks and onion and garlic to the full. You didn't have all you can eat. You were slaves. You were servants to Egypt. You had to make brick and sometimes without straw. Joshua was part of them and came through the whole experience with them. And so God chose as a successor to Moses someone that had grown up with the children of Israel. In fact, as you know, God didn't let anybody that was over 20 years old that walked through the wilderness enter into the promised land because they murmured and complained against God. Six different times they said, would to God we were back in Egypt. And so God slew all of those over 20. So Joshua and Caleb are two old-timers with a bunch of youngsters around them. And God didn't choose one of the college-educated, technologically savvy youngsters. He chose one of the older men. He told Joshua to be chose Joshua to be the leader, one that had come through that servanthood with them. So we read about Joshua's background as a son, as a slave. Number three, as a soldier. Joshua has been well prepared by God as a son, as a slave, and as a soldier. Go, if you would, back to Exodus chapter 17. Again, this is the first time we read the name Joshua in our Bibles. And in Joshua chapter 17, we begin to see the formulation of the character of Joshua and his closeness to Moses. Joshua was not Moses' handpicked successor. He was God's handpicked successor. But he worked with Moses for a long time. Notice in Exodus 17 and verse 8. And then came Amalek and fought with Israel in Rephidim. And Moses said unto Joshua, you ought to circle that name or underline it. That's the first time that name appears in the Bible. Moses said to Joshua, choose us out men and go out, fight with Amalek. Tomorrow I will stand upon the top of the hill with the rod of God in my hand. So Joshua did as Moses said to him and fought with Amalek. Then notice, if you would, down in verse number 13. And Joshua discomfited Amalek and his people with the edge of the sword. Joshua was the one that led Israel in their very first battle as they came out of the Egypt and were headed toward Canaan. And the first enemy that showed up was Amalek, the Amalekites. And Moses said to Joshua, get some men together, you go out and lead them, and you fight against them. And God discomfited the Amaleks, and Joshua slew them with the sword. So Joshua's got his training as a soldier. Then notice number four, his background as a servant. As a servant. It's great to have the good resume. It's great to be a soldier. It's great to be a general. It's great to be a military leader. But you can tend to be too high. You can tend, if you've given orders all your life, it's kind of hard now to be in a position where you have to take them sometimes. But we see the balance in Joshua's life that not only was he this soldier, but he was a servant. Look at Numbers chapter 11. Numbers chapter 11. Looking at the balance of the preparation of Joshua's life. And the point of this is simply this, folks. God is preparing you and I for service for him. Now, we are sons or daughters. We might never be slaves, and we might not have been soldiers, but we can all be servants. But God has used in our life the different circumstances and the different things to prepare us for how he wants to use us. I think all of us could look back at our life and look at some circumstances that have been orchestrated in our life. I look back, and even before I was saved, how God put some people into my life that prepared me to serve him after I got saved. God is a great orchestra leader. He's a great conductor. And in Joshua's life, he's doing the same thing. Before it's time, Joshua's time to serve, it's his time to lead, he's chosen to serve. He's a servant. Numbers chapter 11, verse number 28. Joshua chapter 11, Numbers chapter 11, verse 28. And Joshua, the son of Nun, notice the next words, the servant of Moses. The servant of Moses. Somebody said this recently, and I'm not sure where it was. It was here or somewhere where I heard some preacher say it. The best leaders were the best servants. Those that are best apt to lead were those that were apt to serve. And Joshua was just that kind of person. He was the servant of Moses. We don't need to turn there, but in Exodus chapter 24, verse 13, it calls him Moses' minister. Moses' minister. And we know in the New Testament the word minister means servant. Those that are called to serve are called to minister. It means to minister to the needs of other people. I keep this foremost in my mind. When we have church on Wednesday night, I don't want you to be in church because I want you to be there for me. You don't come to church Sunday morning, Sunday night for the preacher. But I come Sunday morning, Sunday night for you, to give you the Word of God, to give you something that hopefully will strengthen your faith and encourage your faith and build your faith. That's what a minister, that's what a servant does. And Joshua was Moses' minister. Can you imagine being the minister of Moses? That was his preparation for leadership, being a servant. It also calls him that in Joshua chapter 1 and verse 1, that he was Moses' minister. He was the natural successor to Moses because of his proximity. You know that when Moses went up to the top of the mountain to get the Ten Commandments, one man went up the mountain with him. That was Joshua. He wasn't allowed to go all the way up. He was allowed to go halfway up and then meet Moses as he came down. But Joshua was a servant to Moses and had special privilege. And because of that, he was the natural successor. Joshua is so dedicated to Moses. There was a time that two guys in the book of Numbers, Eldad and Medad, were down in the camp of Israel when Moses wasn't there, and they were down there prophesying. And Joshua heard them prophesying. Everything they said was right, but Joshua got angry and went back to Moses and said, hey, there's two men down there that are prophesying in the camp, and they weren't sent by you. Go down there and rebuke them and tell them they shouldn't be prophesying. And Moses said, would to God all God's prophets were, or all God's people were prophets and would prophesy. But Joshua just had that devotion to Moses. And so he was the natural successor because he was a servant. His background, number five, as a spy. His background as a spy. And you know the story. It's back there in Numbers chapter 14. Numbers chapter 14. And we've talked about this a little bit already. Numbers chapter 14 and verse 6. And Joshua the son of Nun and Caleb the son of Jephunneh, which were of them that searched the land, rent their clothes, and they spake unto the company of the children of Israel, saying, the land which we pass through to search it is an exceeding good land. If the Lord delight in us, then he will bring us into this land and give it us, a land which floweth with milk and honey. Only rebel not ye against the Lord, neither fear the people of the land, for they are bread for us. Their defense is departed from us, and the Lord is with us. Fear them not. But all the congregation bade stone them with stones, and the glory of the Lord appeared in the tabernacle of the congregation before all the children of Israel. And the Lord said unto Moses, how long will this people provoke me? Joshua and Caleb were the two of the 12 that went in and saw the land and came back and said, we can have it. If God wants us to have it, we can have it. He had a positive outlook. And that's what God was looking for as a successor for Moses. Somebody not somebody down on his luck. He was going to have to lead 3 million Jews into the promised land. He had to have a positive outlook. He had to lead the people that kept saying, as I've said over and over, would to God we were back in Egypt. He had to lead them. So he had to have a good demeanor about him. He couldn't be easily discouraged. And we see in his profession or in his calling as a spy that when 10 were against it, he was for it. He didn't have to follow the majority. He could do what he knew God wanted him to do. And he could stand up even when the congregation spake of stoning him. He still said, I don't care what they say. I think God can give us this land. So we see the background of Joshua, how God has prepared him for leadership through servanthood. All right, then we look secondly, or letter B, at his behavior. We've seen his background. Now we look at Joshua's behavior. He is an Old Testament saint. Now, you gotta be careful when you say saint because some folks get, Kevin, I got to explain this to you. You got to be careful with that word saint because of those that have that different. A saint is not some dead guy that you pray to help you when you're in trouble. A saint is someone who's living. Precious in the Lord is the death of one of his saints, all right? That's somebody that's alive, and he's already a saint. He doesn't become a saint afterward. Joshua was a saint while he was alive. You and I, the Bible says in the New Testament, are called to be saints. What does that mean? Our lives ought to show it, like Joshua's did. When God's looking for a leader, he was the son, he was the slave, he's a soldier, he's a servant, he's a spy. He's looking for those natural tendencies, those human elements to be that training and that background. But God's looking far, far beyond that. If he's really going to be a leader, he's got to not only be a good man, he's got to be a godly man. He's looking for the spiritual qualifications as well as the physical qualifications. So we look at Joshua's life and his behavior, number one, filled with the Spirit of God. Wouldn't you like to have a leader that was a son, a slave, a soldier, a servant, a spy, that kind of background, and yet at the same time he's filled with the Spirit of God? There's the kind of leadership we need. That's what our country needs right now. I don't know where you're going to find somebody like that, but that's what we need. He was filled with the Spirit of God. Deuteronomy chapter 34, verse 9, I put the reference there so you don't necessarily have to turn it. But it talks about Joshua, the son of Nun, full of the Spirit of wisdom. So Joshua had not only that secular background, but he's got a spiritual background that qualifies him to lead. He's going to be a good leader. Number two, not only was he filled with the Spirit of God, but he enjoyed the presence of God. He enjoyed the presence of God. In Joshua, well, look there, if you're there, I'm in Joshua. Joshua chapter 1, verse 5. Just keep yourself, your place in Joshua, because that's where we're going to be most of the time. But Joshua chapter 1, verse 5. God says to Joshua, "There shall not any man be able to stand before thee all the days of thy life. As I was with Moses, so I will be with thee." There's the promise of the presence of God in his life. As I was with Moses, Joshua, so I will be with you. That had to be reassuring to Joshua. That had to be comforting. Because Moses is no longer around, and we'll talk about that more in a moment. He's gone, and Joshua's on his own. There's no one else to counsel him that's over 20 years old. Because they've all been killed off because of their murmuring and complaining. He's got no elders to go to. And so who's going to help him? Well, God says, I'll be with you. As I was with Moses, Joshua, I'll also be with you. It also says that, look at Joshua chapter 6. Joshua chapter 6 and verse number 27. And this is after the battle of Jericho, which we'll look at in a minute. Joshua chapter 6, verse 27. So the Lord was with Joshua. He was filled with the Spirit of God. He enjoyed the presence of God. Number three, he was obedient to the will of God. Obedient to the will of God. Isn't this the kind of leader you'd like to have today? Not only that has the background, the training, the preparation, but has the spiritual foundation. He was obedient to the will of God. Deuteronomy chapter 32, verse 12 said that Joshua wholly followed the Lord. Wholly, not H-O-L-Y, but W-H-O-L-L-Y. He wholly followed the Lord. When you're reading through Kings and Chronicles and you read about all these kings that succeeded the previous king, you know, and Ahab who did wickedness before the sight of the God, there's only a few of the kings that the Bible says that they wholly followed the Lord. Joshua was one of those Old Testament characters that the Bible tells us did so. Look in Joshua chapter 14. We'll just look at the references in Joshua. Look at Joshua chapter 14. Joshua is years later talking to the children of Israel about when he spied out the land. He says in Joshua 14 and verse 8, "Nevertheless, my brethren that went up with me made the heart of the people melt, but I wholly followed the Lord my God." Joshua wholly followed the Lord. He was obedient to the will of God. So he's filled with the Spirit of God, enjoyed the presence of God, obedient to the will of God. And number four, led by the Word of God. Led by the Word of God. Joshua chapter 1, and probably the key verse of the book of Joshua, one of the two verses. The other will be Joshua 24, and we'll look at that in a moment. But Joshua chapter 1, verse 8. Again, as Joshua is going to have to lead 3 million Jews into the promised land, doesn't have Moses there by his side to help him, doesn't have really any elders of Israel to give him any guidance. He's pretty much all by himself. But God says, no, I'm with you. And he says in Joshua chapter 1, verse 8, "This book of the law shall not depart out of thy mouth, but thou shalt meditate therein day and night." Now, first of all, let's stop. What is this book of the law? It's the writings of Moses. The book of the law is what we call the Pentateuch, the first five books of the Bible. Genesis, Exodus, Leviticus, Numbers, Deuteronomy, all written by Moses. Joshua got to hear with his own ears most of the book of Deuteronomy. Because Deuteronomy was Moses giving the children of Israel their history since they came out of Egypt. He was there with Moses in the mountain when he received the Ten Commandments in the book of Exodus chapter 20. And so Moses has all these things, the writings of God. And God tells him, this book of the law shall not depart out of the mouth, but thou shalt meditate therein day and night. Joshua, when you need help, I'll give it to you. When you need to know what direction to go, Joshua, God says, I'll give it to you through the book of the law, that thou mayest observe to do according to all that is written therein. That's what God requires us to do. All that is written therein. For then thou shalt make thy way prosperous, and then thou shalt have good success. Joshua, if you'll stick to my word, you'll have everything you need. He was filled with the Spirit of God, enjoyed the presence of God, obedient to the will of God, led by the Word of God. He's got the spiritual characteristics to go along with the natural characteristics. John Jay, you'll remember this, was one of our founding fathers. He was the president of the Continental Congress, one of the writers of the Federalist Papers, our first Supreme Court justice, the first Chief Justice of the Supreme Court, appointed by George Washington. That's John Jay. And later, the governor of New York. And he believed that our country was a Christian nation. John Jay did. Of course, he was alive back there when it happened. He wasn't some yahoo in the 21st century saying, no, it wasn't a Christian nation. He was alive right there to see it with his own eyes. And John Jay said this, Providence has given to our people the choice of their leaders. In most countries back in that day where there was a dictatorship or a monarchy, we were founded as a republic and we got to vote for our leaders. John Jay said, Providence, which of course is God, has given to our people the choice of their rulers, and it is the duty as well as the privilege and interest of our Christian nation to select and prefer Christians for their rulers. You know, our nation's in a mess. Because we don't look for spiritual qualifications. We look for the son, the slave, the soldier, the servant, the spy. We look at the backgrounds in economics and political science and the business world, but we don't care about the spiritual side. We'll settle for anything. And we've got the nation we've got. We've got the mess that we've got in our hands. Now, the sad thing is, we don't have a lot of choices most of the time. The guys that are thrown up there on the plate to give us the offer, none of them are going to take us back to God. But John Jay said our duty as well as our privilege and interest to select and prefer Christians for their rulers. You and I need to be praying for the next presidential election that God somewhere is going to bring up somebody that's got the spiritual background, not just the natural background. Because the only hope for our nation as we go that direction is to get somebody. Wouldn't it be great to have a Joshua? Wouldn't it be great to find out there's a Joshua out there in the wings somewhere just waiting for 2014? The next, is it 2016? Just waiting out there for the next election? It'd be great to have a Joshua out there somewhere. He had that background. He had the behavior. He had all he needed. He was ready to succeed Moses when Moses was done. Notice then number three, or letter C, his battles. His background, his behavior, his battles. You know why he needed a good background? You know why he needed a good spiritual qualifications? Because leadership is a battle. Leadership is never easy. Leadership means many times stepping out before other people when they're not willing to follow. And trying to get people to follow when they're reluctant to follow. The children of Israel, I wish we were back in Egypt. No, here, follow me. Let's go in the land of Canaan. Oh, no. The Amorites there and the Hittites and the Perizzites and the Jebusites are all, oh, we can't go in there. And Joshua has to say, come on, follow me. And all through Joshua, the book of Joshua, you know what the book of Joshua is about? It's about battles. Look at Joshua chapter 6. We'll just look at this briefly. Joshua chapter 6, as the Negroes used to sing, Joshua fit the battle of Jericho. That's what Joshua chapter 6 is, the battle of Jericho. His battles, number one, against major foes. Against major foes. Joshua had some formidable enemies that he had to conquer. One of those was the city of Jericho. fortified by a wall all the way around it. Walls so wide that chariots would race on those walls. We're not talking about a little brick wall that you can punch a hole through. We're talking about wide walls around a big, prosperous city. And they're in the way of the children of Israel getting into the promised land, and Joshua's got to fight the battle of Jericho. Now, you know when you read chapter 6 that God does something highly unusual. He tells him in verse number 3, "Ye shall compass the city, all you men of war, and go round about the city once. Thus shall you do for 6 days." Get all the soldiers together, Joshua, and march around the city. Once on the first day, once on the second day, the third day, the fourth day, the fifth day. That's the battle plan. Don't fire a weapon. They're to be silent. Don't even say a word. For 6 days, march around the city. I'm sure the first day, the people of Jericho were nervous, watching over the wall, seeing the children of Israel, this big army of millions of people march around and thinking, what in the world's going on? We're in trouble here. And they march around, they don't say a word. The second day, they get out there and do the same thing, and the people in Jericho start wondering, what in the world's going on? And the third day, same thing. After a little while, I'm sure the people in Jericho start probably mocking, probably even start throwing stuff from the wall down at them. The fourth day and the fifth day, marching, you know, you can imagine the ridicule, and they weren't allowed to say a word. Then in verse number 4, "The seven priests shall bear before the ark 7 trumpets of ram's horns. And the seventh day you shall compass the city 7 times, and then the priests shall blow with the trumpets." On the seventh day, they were to go around 7. That was the battle plan. That sure ain't going to impress many people. You say, what happened? I know you know the story. Look down at verse number 20. "So the people shouted when the priest blew with the trumpet. It came to pass when the people heard the sound of the trumpet and the people shouted with a great shout that the wall fell down flat." The wall fell down flat. That was the battle that Joshua fought at Jericho. They marched around at one time for 6 days. The seventh day, they marched around it 7 times. And when they shouted, the wall fell flat. You say, how did that happen? God knocked the wall down. Archaeologists or the skeptics of our day will tell us, well, see, what happened is all those Jews walking around the city all that time, the rumbling of their feet shook the foundation. And then all it took on the seventh day was Ella Fitzgerald's loud, you know, high pitch. Some of you don't know what I'm talking about. All it took on the seventh day was a loud shout, and the walls fell down because they were crumbling from the Jews. I got a job for you. You come here Monday and walk all the way around this building. Then come back and do it Tuesday and Wednesday. Don't say a word. I'm going to be here studying. I don't want to hear anything. But you come for 6 days and walk around on the seventh day, walk around it 7 times and shout and see if this building falls to the ground or not. You can even bring a bunch of people with you. I don't care. This is not Jericho. But you can bring 20 or 30 people and do that for 6. I got news for you. By the time you'll lose some pounds because it's about 90 degrees out there every day and walk around will be good exercise for you. But these walls are not going to fall down. And the walls of Jericho did not fall down because of the shaky foundation. After those walls were thick. They fell down because God knocked them down. Joshua was obedient to God in doing it the way God said it, when he probably could have said, God, I got a better plan than that. But Joshua had major foes. Look at Joshua chapter 7. We go down to number 2. Joshua had minor foes. Joshua had minor foes. In Joshua chapter 7 and 8, he fights against the city of Ai. Ai ain't Jericho. Excuse my grammar. Ai ain't Jericho. It's not a big fortified city. It's a small little city. They could knock it off with no problem. At least that's what they thought. Look at chapter 7 and verse number 2. "And Joshua sent men from Jericho to Ai, which is beside Beth-Aven and the east side of Bethel. Spake unto them, saying, Go up and view the country. And the men went up and viewed Ai. And they returned to Joshua and said unto him, Let not all the people go up, but let about 2 or 3,000 men go up." We don't need 3 million like we had march around Jericho. Let's have 2 or 3,000. Ai is a small city. We can knock it off. You know what they're doing? They're saying, we did it. We knocked down Jericho. We can take Ai. Can I tell you what happens in Joshua chapter 7? They go fight against Ai, and 36 of their own men are slain. None of the enemy is slain, and they run with their tail between their legs because they took confidence in themselves. They thought they could do it themselves. This was a minor battle. Hey, if we can win the major battle, we can win the minor battle, and they forgot God. So in chapter 8, they fight against them again. This time, they beseech God, and God gives Joshua a battle plan. The first time an ambush is ever used in battle. They go against Ai, and some of the men are on the west, and some of them are on the north. The ambush is on the west. Joshua and all his men are on the north. And Joshua and his men come to Ai and start to fight against it, and all the men of Ai go out. Joshua and his men start turn tail and running for the hills like they're defeated. The men of Ai are chasing them out, saying, oh, we got them whipped, and they run farther and farther from the city. And when they get far enough away, Joshua turns back and points his sword back, and the men from the west that were laying in ambush come in and set the city on fire. And now the men of Ai are between two groups with nowhere to go. Their city's been destroyed. They got nowhere to go. And Joshua wins the battle because God gave him the battle plan. They depended on God again for their minor battles as well as their major battles. Sometimes we think things are so small, we don't need God's help. This is insignificant. I don't need to pray about this. They didn't pray about that battle, and they got defeated. So a major foe in Joshua 6, minor foes in Joshua 7 and 8. Number 3, in Joshua chapter 9, they fight against moderate foes. Moderate foes, Joshua chapter 9. In Joshua chapter 9, in verse 3, when the inhabitants of Gibeon heard that Joshua, all that Joshua had done to Jericho and to Ai, all right, the major battle and the minor battle, when the people of Gibeon heard all that, verse 4, they did work wilily, like Wile E. Coyote. Remember that guy? They worked wilily. They were conniving. And went and made it as if they'd been ambassadors, and took old sacks upon their asses, and wine bottles old and rent and bound up, and old shoes and clouted upon their feet, and old garments upon them, and all the bread of their provision was dry and moldy. And they went to Joshua into the camp of Gilgal, and said unto him, to the men of Israel, we be come from a far country. They weren't from a far country. They were from the next town over. But Joshua had defeated Jericho. Now he had beat Ai. Now the men of Gibeon said, if we don't do something, we're going to get wiped out too. So they faked it. They feigned it. They put old wine bottles and old wineskins and old shoes on their feet and old clothes on their back and moldy bread in their baskets to make it look like they'd come from a long way when they actually came from the next town over. And that town was one that Joshua was commanded by God to destroy and wipe out because he wanted the idolaters out of the land, and the Gibeonites were idolaters. And they came to him, and the men of Israel said to the Hivites, they said in verse 9, we came from a very far country. Thy servants are come because of the name of the Lord thy God, and we have heard the fame of him. And they want to make a covenant with him that they'll not destroy them. And Joshua says, are you really from a long ways away? Yes, we are. And so Joshua says, all right, we won't fight against you. We won't destroy you. Notice verse number 14. And the men took of their victuals and asked not counsel at the mouth of the Lord. Here's that moderate battle. It's not really a battle, not like Jericho and Ai. They're not even fighting. But they're being deceived by the men of Gibeon who have come and faked like they came from a far land. And the Bible tells us that they didn't even pray and ask God about it. It wasn't important enough. It wasn't big enough. And they made a covenant with the enemy that God had told Joshua to destroy because they didn't seek counsel from the mouth of the Lord. You know what came of that? Years later, Saul became king in 1 Samuel. And Saul went in and destroyed the Gibeonites. He broke the promise of Israel to the Gibeonites. And because of that, Israel paid for it. They made a promise that they didn't keep. They made the promise in the days of Joshua, but it was a binding promise. Saul knew about it and didn't keep it. And over in 2 Samuel, we read later that when David's the king and wants to make peace with the Gibeonites, he said, what can I do to appease you because of that? And it's, seven or eight, I forget the number. I think it's seven of Saul's sons are taken and hanged in Gibeah because of the broken covenant between Saul and the Gibeonites. And it all happened because Joshua didn't pray about it before he did it. Joshua's a wonderful leader. He's a godly leader, but he's still human. He still made mistakes. He sent to the battle of Ai when he took it lightly. Now he makes a decision without praying, and they pay for it. That's major foes, minor foes, moderate foes. And in Joshua chapter 10, multiplied foes. Joshua chapter 10, multiplied foes. It just got worse. Jericho was the easiest of the battles. All they had to do was march around. No casualties. No covenants with foreign powers. But in Joshua chapter 10, Down in verse 5. Therefore the five kings of the Amorites, and the king of Jerusalem, and the king of Hebron, and the king of Jarmuth, and the king of Lachish, and the king of Eglon, gathered themselves together and went up all their hosts and encamped before Gibeon, now that Israel is there, and made war against it. And the men of Gibeon sent to Joshua to the camp of Gilgal, saying, slack not thy hand to come from thy servants. Come up to us quickly and save us and help us. For all the kings of the Amorites that dwell in the mountains are gathered together against us. In chapter 10, Joshua has to fight against the kings of the south. That's those kings in verse number 5. In chapter 11, he has to fight against the kings of the north. Chapter 11, verse 1, it came to pass when Jabin, king of Hazor, heard those things that he sent to Joab, king of Madon, and the king of Shimron, and the king of Asphat, to the kings that were of the north of the mountains, and of the plain south of Chinnereth, in the valley, and the borders of Dor, to the Canaanite, to the Amorite, the Hittite, the Perizzite, the Jebusite, the Hivite. Joshua had to fight all of these multiplied foes. Those were Joshua's battles all throughout the book of Joshua, trying to get into the promised land. He had to be a soldier. He had to have that background, but he had to have the spiritual preparation if he's going to be victorious. Then lastly, letter D, we see his brethren. His brethren. Joshua led alone, but he led the people. So that's what it was all about. It was about the people. It wasn't about Joshua. Joshua is going to die at 110 years old, and whatever happens afterward is going to happen. It's not about Joshua. It's about the people. He had to lead them, number one, into their new land. He had to lead them into their new land. Look over at Joshua chapter 24. We just read these names in Joshua chapter 11, but Joshua 24 and verse 11. Joshua 24 and verse 11, you went over Jordan and came to Jericho, and the men of Jericho fought against you, the Amorite, the Perizzite, the Canaanite, the Hittites, the Girgashites, the Hivites, the Jebusites, and I delivered them into your hand. I delivered them, God says, I delivered them into your hand. They were given their new land, the land of Canaan, the land flowing with milk and honey, the promised land. Joshua led these people into that promised land. Number two, not only their new land, but their new life. Their new life. They're going to have a life of peace. They're going to have a life without battles. Joshua chapter 22, look at verse number 5. They have new commands now. The command is not to fight the Amorites, the Hittites, the Perizzites, the Girgashites, and all that. Joshua says in chapter 22 and verse 5, but take diligent heed to do the commandment of the law which Moses, the servant of the Lord, charged you. Notice, to love the Lord your God and to walk in all his ways and to keep his commandments and to cleave unto him and to serve him with all your heart and with all your soul. That's the new life that Joshua is giving to the children of Israel. Hey, the battles are fought. The battles are over. The battles are won. Now it's time to cling to God. Now it's time to be devoted and dedicated to God. You know, the opposite is usually what's true. When the battles are going, people are turning to God. When peacetime comes, they turn away. Joshua says, hey, it's peacetime now. God's delivered all those enemies into your hand. You've got a new life. Look at chapter 23 and verse number 5. The Lord your God, this is what he promised them, the Lord your God, he shall expel them from before you and drive them out of your sight. And ye shall possess their land as the Lord your God hath promised you. Be ye therefore very courageous to keep and to do all that is written in the book of the law of Moses, that ye turn not aside thereto to the right hand or to the left. Joshua is giving them a challenge as he's getting ready. Verse number 1 tells us that Joshua waxed old and was stricken in age. As Joshua is coming to the end of his life, he's encouraging them in this new life. Walk with God. Keep the law of Moses. Do those things that are important. Look at verse 11 of Joshua 23. Take good heed therefore unto yourselves that you love the Lord your God. Take good heed to yourselves that you love the Lord your God. He's giving a commandment to his brethren. Their new land, their new life. And then finally, number 3, their new Lord. their new Lord. Not, it's not a new one, but it's a renewed covenant. They have turned. You know, when God said to go in and wipe out the Hivites, the Girgashites, the Jebusites, the Canaanites, all that, I've said this a lot recently. God didn't want them wiped out because of their nationality. He didn't want them wiped out because they spoke a different language. He didn't want them wiped out because they had a different skin color. He wanted them wiped out because they were idolatrous, immoral people. And he didn't want that to infect the children of Israel. So he said, when you go to the land, I want you to get rid of every one of them. Get rid of all of them, because if you leave any of them behind, they're going to corrupt you. And when you read in the book of Numbers, you find out that they went into the land and they did not fully expel the Jebusites. And they went in there and did not fully get rid of the Canaanites. And the Bible tells us that they didn't. And then years later, because of that, they went into the idolatry that those enemies of God were practicing that influenced them. So Joshua was telling them, I want you to make this covenant with God. When they are expelled from the land, be very courageous to keep and to do all that your God commands you. Look at verse number 21 of Joshua chapter, Joshua chapter 24, verse 14. Joshua 24, verse 14. Now therefore, fear the Lord and serve him in sincerity and truth, and put away the gods which your fathers served on the other side of the flood and in Egypt, and serve the Lord. And if it seem evil unto you to serve the Lord, choose you this day whom you will serve, whether the gods which your fathers served, which were on the other side of the flood, or the gods of the Amorites, in whose land you dwell. Then Joshua says these famous words, but as for me and my house, we will serve the Lord. Joshua challenges the children of Israel to serve their Lord. Verse number 21. And the people said to Joshua, we will serve the Lord. Verse number 24. And the people said unto Joshua, the Lord our God will we serve, and his voice will we obey. And verse 31. And Israel served the Lord all the days of Joshua, and all the days of the elders that overlived Joshua. Remember, there were no elders when Joshua took over. But those that he raised from 20 years old and upward for the next 30 years of his life, when they got there, as long as they were alive that had known Joshua, the children of Israel served the Lord. All that by the influence of Joshua, Moses' successor. God had prepared him. God had provided for him. God had kept him pure to serve him. And Joshua became the leader that Israel needed. Folks, you and I are probably not going to be a Joshua. We're not going to lead 3 million people. We might only lead a household. We might only lead our immediate family. But we need to lead them correctly. And God has shaped every one of our lives. As Christians, God has involved himself in every one of our lives to give us exactly the traits and the tools necessary to be the right kind of leader. But it takes courage. When you read through Joshua, go do what I did. I underlined with either blue or green. Every time that Joshua told the people, be very courageous, be strong and very courageous. Because to be the right kind of leader, that's what it takes. Whether it's leading in your home, whether it's leading in the church, whether it's leading in a business situation, whatever it is, it takes being strong and courageous. And Joshua had those characteristics. He was prepared by God to lead. Let's stand together tonight with our heads bowed and our eyes closed.